You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
My guest this week is Jenny Boyd. She is the author of Musicians in Tune, 75 Contemporary Musicians Discuss the Creative Process, also published as It's Not Only Rock and Roll, Iconic Musicians Reveal the Source of Their Creativity. She holds a PhD and is a renowned expert in treatment for addiction. She's a former model and was everywhere that anything groovy was happening in the 1960s, including Haight Ashbury in the Summer of Love and India with the Beatles. She was the inspiration for one of your favorite songs, a big hit for Donovan, which is also the title of Jenny Boyd's new memoir, Jennifer Juniper, A Journey Beyond the Muse. Dr. Jenny Boyd, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. Lovely to be here.
I didn't know where to start, but I thought maybe you could recount for us that moment when Donovan first played that song for you.
Okay. I was at the moment, at that time, I was working in the Apple Boutique in London, and we were all waiting to go to India, which was going to be like 2-3 months later. And Donovan popped into the shop and didn't know that I was working there because I'd met him before. And he was thrilled. And obviously, he was interested in my trip to San Francisco and about what was going on there. And also because we'd been to Wales to get our meditation, get our mantra from Maharishi at that time. So he was curious to know. He was obviously on his own in a sort of spiritual search. So we sat in one of the dressing rooms, and I think about a couple of hours went by while we carried on talking. I was meant to be serving customers. But anyway, he invited me to come over to, about a week or so later, to his manager's house. They're having lunch. And after lunch, he said, I've got something to show you. And so he took me to this room, a bedroom, and he was sat at the headboard with his guitar, and I was sitting cross-legged at the other end, and he started singing Jennifer Juniper. And I had no idea, and it was the prettiest song I think I'd ever heard. I love his voice, I love the way he plays his guitar, but also I realized it was a sort of declaration of love too. And I wasn't quite sure whether I was sort of at that point, but anyway, it was really, really special. And actually having a song that's written for you, it stayed with me all these years. And when I hear it, you know, I've heard it as Muzak in a supermarket, or, you know, I know that people have called their children Juniper. And, you know, it's one of those things it always does for me. It reminds me of a very innocent time. It just conjures it all up. So it's beautiful. And I feel exceedingly lucky to have my own song.
And it's a great song. I'm thinking of what it would be like if she loved me. So was there a little bit of discomfort then when you realized,
I was 19. So it was sort of exciting too, because I liked hanging out with him a bit. And, but I think, you know, as one reads on from in the book, that there was a part of me that was still in a way, feeling that I was kind of going out and experimenting what life was like, but that I would be going back to Mick at one point, you know, because Mick Fleetwood and I had known each other since we were 16. So although I felt I was free and easy, I don't know, I was sort of not quite ready to have a relationship, full relationship. But we saw each other on and off for quite a while.
Well, now that just brings up all these personal questions that I want to ask you. So before I get to those, I want to ask you, so you've written this memoir, and you didn't seem to have a co-writer. You wrote it all.
I wrote it all. Yeah. I had an editor who helped me with three chapters when I had an agent. Then I got rid of the agent. And when we were trying to get it to publishers, and she was brilliant. I really, really like her. And she helped me. What she helped me with those three chapters, it wasn't doing track changes or anything like that. It was so Donovan wrote a song for you. That was my favorite song when I was growing up. You can't just say, Donovan wrote a song for me called Jennifer Juniper. You know, what did it feel like? So she was doing all this. And so although she only helped me with the three chapters, I carried on because I'd already written all the chapters and sort of went over them, edited them myself, almost hearing her voice. You know, expand on this. or don't need so much of that. And so it was like I internalized what she'd said.
And your memories are very vivid, but was it, are there parts of it, as you know, here I am, a complete stranger, about to ask you some personal questions, because you you know, I think some memoirs, you read them and you enjoy them, but this memoir, I mean, I really feel like, you know, you and I are old friends now, even though you haven't met me, but I've spent hours with you.
Yeah.
Is it uncomfortable to have revealed some personal things about you that anybody reading the book now knows?
No. And people thank me for being so honest and being so sort of exposing myself in many ways. No, it doesn't, because I am on a true journey of, you know, inner awareness, and, you know, that is a search. And I know we're all human and we've all kind of screwed up in different ways and not in others. And it's the journey. And we all go on some sort of journey because we're human beings, aren't we?
Yes. Well, so now in the kind of the Me Too era, there does seem to be a thing that people put a move on you, so to speak, throughout your life that you were unprepared for or unexpecting. Any thoughts on that?
Mick always said I'm so naive. Because I, you know, I think, oh gosh, they're so nice. That guy's so sweet, and you know, we really sort of get on well. And he said, but he's after you, and I'd always thought, no, he's not. You know, and that would go on a lot. And even now, if Mick was here, he'd be laughing because, you know, even my kids say, Dad says that you were really naive, Mum. You know, so I just thought everyone was being really friendly a lot of the time. I suppose because, yeah, I was naive.
And do you feel that, you know, that you were manipulated into situations, even relationships that you didn't necessarily want to be in?
Yeah. Yes. Because I haven't had into my life that many relationships. So definitely there are two that I didn't want to be in and I felt manipulated in and I didn't know how to get out. So, yes. But the others, you know, is Mick and... you know, that I married another drummer, actually, Ian Wallace, many years later. And then I'm married now to an architect and been married for the last 24 years, which is a record for me. So, yes, you're right.
Well, so you've been married now for 24 years, and that's, congratulations, that's lovely. When I read your sister Patty Boyd's book, when I read Eric Clapton's book, too, one of the thoughts that I had was, you know, Eric Clapton, he's like so in love with Patty that he writes this incredible song and he, you know, in a way betrays his best friend because Patty was his best friend's wife.
Yeah.
And then their relationship lasted like not very long in the scheme of things. So was there and you also say in your book that you didn't want to get involved with a man if there was no potential for a long-term relationship. So was there an ethos in those days that long-term relationships meant, you know, like a month? Or
No, for me, it's like my first boyfriend, and that was the one that I felt sort of manipulated in because I was so naive. I mean, I really was, and I was, what, 16. You're so young, and I didn't have any male role models, you know. I had a father who was a PTSD trauma survivor, a stepfather who was really, you know, beat us and really not very nice at all. So I didn't have anything resembling a good, healthy male role model. So the first guy that I went out with, and he was quite a bit older than me, who he was in the band Mick was in called the Shanes. I don't know, I've just lost your question. I got so involved in...
Well, about long-term relationships.
Oh, yeah. So I was with him for about a year. And then with Mick...
When you're 16, that's a lot.
That's a long time. Because I thought, I had no idea about just dating. I've never really just dated. I thought, you know, a guy kisses you, then you're stuck with him for a year. Hold on.
But you were an exception because you were more looking for a long-term relationship.
Yes, I must have been. Yeah. And the funny thing is, then Mick and I got together after this guy, Roger, And that felt very sort of natural to me. But I was still very sort of insecure and unsure of myself emotionally, because maybe most teenagers are, women, girls. And so when he did something that didn't feel quite right, that he maybe I took it, oh, well, he doesn't like me anymore or doesn't love me anymore. I'll close it before he does, sort of thing. And then, of course, we get back together again. So that's always been our sort of pattern, was there's a sort of, he has an aloofness, and he knows this, that I, because of my upbringing, take as, oh, he doesn't like me anymore. And for him, it covers a sort of shyness. So, you know, it wasn't the day where you'd go into therapy together and find out, well, what are they saying when they do this? And what is she saying when she does that, you know? And we were terrible at communicating.
Is this a British thing, or is this a Jenny Boyd thing, or is this a McFleetwood thing? Or
I think it was the time. Think it was also a Jenny Boyd thing, and Mick thing too. I mean, we chat now. It's like, you know, we chat on the phone and we can talk for about an hour. But, you know, but at that time, I think we were both painfully shy.
Do you think you relinquished a lot of your power? I mean, looking back on it retrospectively.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. And I think that's what the book's about reclaiming or even finding your own, you know, who you are. And sometimes it can take quite a while.
Yeah.
You know, that saying, Gary, when George asked if I'd like to go to India with them, and I said to him, how can I ever thank you? Because it was like a dream come true. And he said, just be yourself. Well, that's the whole message sort of through the book, really, because it is about just be yourself.
Well, when you contributed lyrics to after Peter Green's departure from Fleetwood Mac, and you wrote some lyrics, but you didn't get any lyric writing credit.
No. And I think that was very much to do with their manager, you know, because I think, boys are cool, boy band, even though Chris McVie was sort of just about to start joining Fleetwood Mac. He was very sort of dismissive, I think, of girlfriends or wives. So you know, had a nickname.
Yeah. Well, that must have, I mean, I would, that would still, I mean, that's not only is it a lack of credit, but I mean, that's lots and lots of financial money that you didn't get over the years.
Yeah, but I didn't think like that. I thought, oh, I'm so glad they like my poems.
Is there anybody left, Sue? I don't know.
Right.
Uh-huh. Speaking of that, I mean, a lot of the, and I'm sure this is difficult because it's happened to all of us, but a lot of the people in your life that you talk about in your memoir are no longer with us. And even since the publication of your memoir, Peter Green has passed away.
Yeah.
And so tell us a little bit about Peter Green. What was he like?
Peter was lovely. And of course, you know, when someone dies, you can't help but sort of go all the way back. And when you first met them, and when I first met him, it was in London in Notting Hill Gate. And he had short hair and these sort of, what they call like these sideburns, you know, like this. And he was very much kind of from the East End and funny. And it was just remembering him, you know, from the very, very early days. And what an inspiration he was to Mick, and Mick just adored him. And over the years, he would say, you know, Peter just oozes with feel. And of course, you know, that's how Mick, he's an intuitive drummer. So that's how he kind of does his very best work. And he was lovely. And I remember when Mick and I got back together, when we were actually decided we would be together and we would get married, when I think we were sort of 20, Peter called me, which was unusual because usually the guys in the band wouldn't get in touch with the girlfriends of their fellow bandmates. And he called me and he said, will you talk to me? I need to talk to you. Will you meet me in the taxi? I'll be downstairs. I'm on my way to see the manager. So I went downstairs and he said to me, I'm feeling something's going, I'm coming, there's a big change coming over me. And it's a sort of spiritual search for meaning. that you've been to San Francisco, you've been to India. What was it like? And you were on your own spiritual search. Tell me about it. How did you first get onto it? And all these very deep questions, which is very unlike the very jokey Peter. And of course, there wasn't enough time. And he never did ask again. But as I was saying, it was he started wearing biblical robes and then he had that song, you know, the man of the world is very sad. I wish I'd never been born. And then after that, I think it was the Green Man Alishi with the two-pronged horn. And that was obviously the beginning of his schizophrenia and what he ended up going through. And it was very sad because I'd meet with him sometimes and he'd say things like, well, you know, I actually felt I was a tiger this morning, and instead of coming out of my front door, I jumped out of the window. So it was really tough, and especially tough for Mick because he just, you know, adored him. And it is sad, you know, it's sad even though he did continue to play, but it was never, you know, there's that same sort of soulfulness that he had.
Did you ever encounter him later in life?
Yeah, I did. I actually had rather a frightening experience, but it was fine. And that was when he was saying that he'd actually got off his medication and he only heard the voices every now and then. And it was nice. It was almost like talking to the old Peter, but not really. And then he said, you know, I wanted to show you something. And he opened up this big trunk and it was just filled with knives, you know, that he had was collecting knives. And I remember thinking, oh, please God, he doesn't hear any voices right now, you know. Then I realized, you know, he's very dear, but the Peter that we knew is, you know, maybe he's there a bit. I don't know what happens, you know, when people get like that.
Of course, you've talked a lot about recovery and treatment in your book and in your life. Do you think that LSD was like the thing that undid Peter Green?
My own personal theory is that for people who are incredibly creative and sort of, you know, verging on genius, really, that the what can be the wall between the conscious and the unconscious can be almost like a sort of gauze, you know, it's so fine. And I think so the unconscious can come into the conscious and then it gets turned into beautiful songs. But I think when you start messing with stuff that's as powerful as LSD, I think it can sort of, you know, make if what was probably already a propensity could actually kind of manifest it, I think.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Jenny Boyd. She's the author of Jennifer Juniper, A Journey Beyond the Muse. In the 1960s, Jenny Boyd was a model in swingin' London. She spent time in the Haight-Ashbury during the Summer of Love. She went to India with the Beatles and was married to Mick Fleetwood of Fleetwood Mac.
I hope this question doesn't sound sexist or stupid, but LSD... a lot of people took it in the 1960s and 70s, mm-hmm. and including us, you and mm-hmm. I. And I talked to Cynthia Lennon one time, and she told me that it was the worst. She only did it one time, and it was absolutely the worst day of her life, and she hated it. And it was the thing, she feels it was the thing that came between her and her husband, John Lennon.
Yes. Do
you think that it was something that men had a different or John thought it was the greatest thing and did it like 100 mm-hmm. times. So is it like do you think there's a difference between the way men and women react to LSD?
Well, maybe if you're the sort of person, because I hated my first trip. I hated it. And I was so fearful and because I didn't want to let go. And I suppose because I was very introverted, but maybe for people who are more extrovert, maybe it's fine because they've got nothing to hang on to. You know, they're so used to sort of being out there. So it's an interesting question, though, because I remember the Grateful Dead, we heard they played on LSD all the time, didn't they? But that's a really interesting question. I don't know.
Do you know, have you encountered a lot of women in your life that said, oh, acid was the greatest thing? Whereas you didn't find men say that all the time.
No. No.
Interesting.
And then when I got to San Francisco, I had a couple more, and they were a little bit lighter, but I found myself always, you know, I'd see people enjoying themselves, having a nice time. I was all still trying to question, what is God? Who am I? You know, all these sort of heavy, for a 19-year-old, you know, it was pretty heavy stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I'm curious also, you, in your new book, Jennifer Juniper, you talk a little bit about your first book, which was a book of interviews with creative musicians. And you talk about this moment that Bob Dylan read your book, and that was a really gratifying moment for you, that he had like dog-eared it and really like read it.
Yeah.
So how have people reacted to your new book? I mean, I want to know the people that you mentioned, like Mick Fleetwood, for instance. Has he read your book? What does he think?
Yeah, he is. He read my book, and it was like, oh gosh, you know, yes. He's kind of took that same behavior on into the next marriage. And I think there was a feeling of slightly, but then the thing is, because I wrote a lot of this stuff for his book too, he knew about it, but he's incredibly supportive. And he's really proud of me, you know, he's really proud of me. He thinks it's a beautiful story. And a lot of people say it's a love story, you know, and it's a journey. And I haven't had one or read any, I think I've read one sort of negative comment, you know, when you look at Amazon or all different, you know, different things you can look at. And this one guy, he said, "Nah, if you're looking for, you know, what was really went on in recording studios, you've got the wrong book." Well, yeah, that's right.
You're not a recording artist.
Fantastic feedback. I really, really have more very heartening and very affirming, really.
What about your daughters? Did they read it?
One hates reading. She's a bit dyslexic like Mick. And she's waiting for the audio tape to come out. The other one, I don't know if she has or not, and I don't know if I want to ask her. You know, it's so funny. It's dedicated to my grandson and my granddaughter. My grandson read it he sucked it up in about 2 days and loved it. And my granddaughter, I think she's just really knocked out because she's 15, that she's got a book that's dedicated to her, you know.
Well, how old are your daughters now?
One daughter will be 50 in January next year, which is extraordinary. She's almost as old as me. And the other daughter is 47.
Well, yeah, wow. So they grew up.
They grew up, sort of. Did any of us? I
don't know. Well, not me, certainly. Absolutely. Talk a little bit about, we were just talking about LSD a minute ago. There was a transition when you got to California from those, I mean, your second trip to California. The transition from grass and LSD to cocaine and really alcohol. I mean, what do you think? Yeah.
Oh, I went for quite a few years because then we went to India, of course, and I thought, oh, meditation, that's it. You know, this is what I've been looking for all this time. And so that was good. So I really didn't have anything. I didn't drink really. And, you know, I smoked a bit of pot a little bit, you know, because my friends did when I got back to London. There was that kind of group of us, but not as much as San Francisco. And it was I didn't really take anything for quite a few years. And of course, because I was having babies and, you know, all that kind of thing. And it wasn't until we got to, it wasn't until we were just about 4 years ago to LA, when I'd go on tour, I didn't really like going on tour because I always felt like Mick's wife and too shy to say anything or talk about anything. And, you know, the band are always very connected. And then I remember one tour thinking, well, I'll try having a drink or two and see if that helps. Sure enough, you know, suddenly become like the sort of belle of the ball or chatting away or laughing. And life becomes a bit more fun because it's pretty intense. I think any mother will say having children and you're the only one, because we are all living in this commune really with the band, and then the road crew would come and sort of doss down. And then when they'd be on the road, I'd just be by myself with the children. And so it's sort of, you know, you've got to be there for your kids. That's your priority. But then you're on the road as well. So it's not easy. But once we got to LA, I kind of became where when I was with the children, I'd be, because we were out in Topanga, I'd be sort of chamomile tea, classical music and, you know, nice gentle evenings. And then if I'd go to the studio and hang out with them, then it would be alcohol, cocaine, party, and so it was not all the time, but it, so it was a kind of very almost skitsy kind of existence.
Well, not so much for you, but for the people that you were with, how did it differ hanging out with people? I mean, it was a different scene if it was cocaine than it was. You said
carry on. I'm sorry.
Not so much looking inward, but and striving for spiritual awareness. Cocaine was a different, completely different kind of thing.
Well, it was, but you know, we were still, because Mick, basically it's because when they met up with Stevie and Lindsay and they got their recording deal, and so that year, beginning of that year, they went in to start recording their first Fleetwood Mac album. And that's where, you know, they got really introduced to cocaine, because they had to finish the album by a certain time. And this meant they could stay up. So Mick could come back, fall asleep, go back to the studio, come back. So the only time I'd see him was if I would go to the studio, I could get someone to look after the kids in Hollywood, which is quite, you know, about an hour's drive away, and just sort of hang out with them. But I didn't really, we just had one friend who came over to America with us, who we all knew because she was, used to be the girlfriend of Peter Green. So that was acceptable, you know, you couldn't just bring anybody into the fold. So, you know, luckily she was around, so I'd sort of hang with her quite a bit. But we didn't have, suddenly the band had lots of people who wanted to be friends with them. Suddenly everybody wanted to be their best friend. So it sort of grew and grew and grew. And I suppose so did the drinking, so did the drug taking.
It seems like, and maybe this is just my own prejudice, but it seems like, you know, when you guys were getting stoned and doing LSD and somebody was writing Jennifer Juniper or, you know, whatever, and then alcohol seems to be the worst of all this substance abuse.
I think cocaine is.
Yeah.
I think, well, alcohol and cocaine. But cocaine is like a heart number, I think. It numbs your heart. It's very, I think it seems not so bad, but I think continual use of it, it turns somebody into something else.
Yeah.
You know, I think in the 60s, like San Francisco, it was people were taking LSD because they were looking for self-awareness. Whereas in the 70s, it became much more all about, it wasn't about looking for self-awareness. That was out the window, as in a general rule.
It was about getting high or staying
getting high.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or finishing the album or, you know, but then once you got the hang of it and the taste of it, it was like the big ball was rolling, you know, that it was, you couldn't get off the treadmill for them. You know,
yeah. Well, you were there for so many momentous. If somebody were to write a historical novel and create a character like you and tell the story of the 60s and 70s, nobody would believe that there would be one girl who would be in all of these places with all these.
I think, you know, because I think I was like a leaf in the wind. I think I just sort of found myself in these places. But when before I went to San Francisco, I had, and I was still modeling, and I could feel, sense something was changing. And, you know, we'd go to clubs with the Beatles, Mick and I, and it was all fun and Dolly Bird-ish, you know. And then I remember one day I had this kind of huge aha moment. I was all by myself, and it was like, you know, time stood still, and it was just this big, and I thought of it as a sort of spiritual awareness, a sort of an awakening, really. And from then on, I thought, I don't want to do modeling. And I wanted to look for people who sort of were thinking in the same way. But my feeling now, looking back at that time, is that there was a huge change about to go on. You know, that was like the collective unconscious. And, you know, people were beginning to get into that sort of finding meaning in life. And then when I went to San Francisco, it's almost as if I was almost drawn to San Francisco, because that's where it was starting to really percolate. And yet I thought I was going to go and help my friend open her shop she wanted to open. You know, so it's funny how you get drawn to places.
Of course, in 1967, I was in California thinking, I want to go to England where the Beatles are. Yeah. So when you first encountered the Beatles, was this because Patty had been cast in A Hard Day's Night? Is that what?
Exactly. Yeah. So I met George first, obviously. And it was amazing when I first met him, because he was much smaller than I thought he was going to be. And also, he was incredibly normal and gentle. And he was just like, you know, your sister's going to meet your sister's new boyfriend.
It turned out to be a Beatle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely thought they were larger than life, because when we saw them, they were up on the screen in A Hard Day's Night.
Did you ever see them?
I saw them in 1966 at Dodger Stadium. They were very small. I could obscure them with my thumb. But but it was a major moment in my life. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I never met any of them or became friends with them, which I would have loved, you know, certainly. Tell me a little bit about that scene. You were on Ready, Steady, Go. Was that the show that you were on?
Yeah. Kathy McGowan, she was the one who hosted it. And I remember when I first went there, I went with Patty because she knew Kathy McGowan. And they had all the singers and bands of that time live. And there weren't that many sort of people in the audience, but you'd be standing up and you'd be dancing and sort of cameras would wheel around you. And so, you know, Eric Burdon and the Animals, or, you know, the Rolling Stones, whoever it was. And then after a while, I've still got my little badge, my little Ready, Steady, Go badge. I'm a dancer. And then Kathy said to me, you just come anytime you like. So I'd get out of my school uniform, I'd go and change in the loo in Notting Hill Gate, put on something else, you know, that was a bit more cool, and go off to the studio in Hoboken. And it was great because I saw so many of those bands just live.
Can you be seen in any of those Ready, Steady, Go?
I don't know, because one day Kathy, because her boyfriend was a hairdresser from a well-known Mayfair hair salon. And so one day she asked me to come up. So I had to stand next to her while she was introducing me. And she said, this is Jenny, you know, with her hair. It was like straight and long, kind of like this, because I haven't cut it for 6 months. and so they did a kind of before and after. And then I had to come back the following week after seeing her boyfriend. You know, he kind of cut it a bit and made it all kind of super nice. So I was on as a sort of, I think she was just giving a plug to her boyfriend's hairdresser.
Oh.
But another thing that I did, another little, I think, what was it? It was a film. I did a couple of sort of short films, as well as I did an advert. I know, it was for I Love Lucy. I was in I Love Lucy.
Right, the Lucy Goes to London.
Dave Clark 5. And Jean Shrimpton, the model, her sister, Chrissy Shrimpton, Twiggy, and there were a couple of other people as well.
So you were in the show. You met Lucy. You
didn't meet Lucy. No. But I did the other kind of short films. I did was very much about 60s. I'd be kind of running around, mixing one of them with me with a promo film. You know, with you'd see the big red letterbox and everything that was to do with the 60s. It was fun. It was really fun.
I bet. And so you went to India. You know, there's sort of always been an enigmatic end to that India trip with the Beatles and the Maharishi. And I think you, in your book, you're sort of implying that Magic Alex, who was a friend of John's, was really more behind it than the Maharishi himself in terms of them leaving.
I would imagine, because actually somebody that we knew in India at that time got in touch with me quite a few years ago because he'd written a book about Maharishi, and because he was a follower of Maharishi. And I think there was definitely, I mean, I know there was because he had proof that there was definitely something that was not too cool. But I felt that Alex, that was not the reason why Alex did that. I feel that Alex came to make trouble because he was jealous of John going off to see his guru. And I think he was saying he should come and see my guru. And I don't think actually he even had a guru, but it was a sort of feeling of he wanted John to be with him.
And you said you weren't even sure exactly what your mantra was.
No, I didn't hear it properly. And yet I just, whatever I thought it was, I just kept using that. But you see, I wasn't that keen on Maharishi when I first met him. Everybody thought he was wonderful, and George was quoting him all the time. And but then, you know, when we had our when we got initiated, I think it was like 3 months before we went to India, and so I had been meditating twice a day, as they said, and I really liked it. So I liked the message more than the messenger.
You were suspicious of him?
Yeah.
Did you think he was wrong?
He really wanted a gold aeroplane. And, you know, he would sort of say things that were incredibly naive in many ways, about money and all this sort of stuff. And I don't know. And I think I don't know if I would have followed any guru, you know, because I felt I'd had my own sort of deep sort of feeling of awakening spiritually. And so I kind of felt it was inside for me rather than giving that over to somebody else.
How well did you know John Lennon?
I didn't know him very well. I mean, you know, every morning we'd all sit on the roof of our bungalow, and John and Paul and George and me and Cynthia and Jane sometimes and Patty. And we'd just listen to them sort of like play music together and chat with each other and come up with songs that later I heard on the White Album. So, but I think when they were playing, one didn't interrupt, and I don't think one would have interrupted whether they were any bunch of musicians who were about to play. But he was very, I thought he was very sweet, and I didn't have any sort of heart-to-heart talks with him, but sort of definite chats and things. And I liked him a lot. And I think he was probably in quite a difficult time at that time, because I think he'd obviously, you know, as we know now, he was obviously had met Yoko, and here was Cynthia, and Cynthia could feel there was a distancing. And I would talk a lot to Cynthia. And then once that finished, and we all, Patty, George and I went to South India, and then, but when we all got back to England, Cynthia wanted to come with me and Donovan to Greece, and Magic Alex was coming too. So she came with us. And it was when we came home, Donovan, Magic Alex and I took her back to where they lived. And John was actually with Yoko. And so that was the sort of, you know,
blow up,
tragic sort of homecoming for her. And, yeah. And John, it was almost like a naughty boy. You know, I remember him on this chaise longue, sort of with his feet sort of up like this. And I was standing at the end thinking, well, I guess we should go, really. You know, it was all feeling very awkward. And then John was wiggling his toes and just going, hello, Jenny. You know, just like a naughty little kid, and mummy's cross with him. It was very strange.
And did you ever connect with Cynthia after that?
Yeah. I think she came to stay with us for a while, and I really felt for her. And then I did meet up with John, and when he was with Yoko, there was some thing going on. I think Alex was giving a show of all the things he'd made or hadn't made. But such is life, isn't it?
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Jenny Boyd. She's the author of Jennifer Juniper, A Journey Beyond the Muse. In the 1960s, Jenny Boyd was a model in swingin' London. She spent time in the Haight-Ashbury during the Summer of Love. She went to India with the Beatles and was married to Mick Fleetwood of Fleetwood Mac.
Yes. So were you working at the Apple boutique when it all fell apart and all of Apple?
Then I'd gone to India. I was there right at the beginning. Then I read somewhere, and I guess it's true, that I was a manager. And then Pete Schotten, who is John's really good friend, he was as well. And it was really fun because I felt this is great. You know, this is like all the shops in San Francisco. And, you know, it represents a whole new way of being and a whole new way of looking at things. And it was very drab in those days in London. It was very black and white. And here they put like this big rainbow stuff, colored stuff on this building. I mean, it's stuff you just did not do in London, you know. And it was very daring and colorful and Indian artifacts.
Well, I know you've traveled a lot and lived a lot of places, but do you still own any of the Apple Boutique clothes?
No, I left a lot of things because I was a house model for these two designers, Fern and Tuffin, who did just the best beautiful clothes. I left so much of that in San Francisco because when we left, immediately after doing our famous walk down Haight-Ashbury, when Patty and George finally came, I'd been writing to them for ages saying, you must come, this is really amazing. So they came and all the hippies had gone to San Francisco and Marin County. And Timothy Leary had said, you know, turn on, tune in, drop out. So all these kids from right across America came and just sort of begging. And so it was a disaster, really. And they just said to me, come on, I think you need to go home. Luckily, I had my passport on me. And I had to leave like a bunch, pretty much everything in San Francisco. Never saw them again.
Oh, that's sad.
Oh, sad.
I wonder where they are. Let's go get them.
I don't know. Someone's wearing them.
Well, your sister, Patty Boyd, she also wrote a book. What's your relationship with her like these days? Are you close?
It's good. It's okay. It's just, you know, with the whole shutdown and everything going on, I'm quite busy because I'm writing what I hope will become a novel. I don't know. I've never written a novel. I don't even know how to. So each day I'm writing. And we are sort of, with my husband and I, have been out in Norfolk, which is like 2 hours north of London. And it's totally isolated, just countryside and woodlands and things. So, I believe she's got a book, a photographic book coming out. Sort of, I don't know, you know, it's changed because of COVID. So,
Has she read your memoir? Do you know?
I don't know. I don't like to ask any of my siblings. Otherwise, I know ones that have offered that they have and really liked it. But I don't like asking anybody who's got it, did you read it?
Right.
That puts pressure because, you know, everybody, I know I've always got a whole pile of books, you know, that I've got sort of waiting.
I do too. But I had no problem with yours. As soon as I picked it up, I was.
Okay.
No. Really? But so I want to ask a little bit about your experience with your father that you talk about in the book, which is a major moment in the book.
Mm.
What was that like? How do you feel about that today?
Well, so just to kind of fill people in a bit, you know, he was a bomber pilot during the Second World War. And there was one night when they're in Malta and two planes, because they had, you know, lights out, were given the green light at the same time. And both of them smashed. They were fully loaded with bombs and they smashed before they could take off. And so his plane just completely blew up in flames. So he was really badly burnt, but pretty much everybody was killed. I think there was another person that survived and somehow he didn't have a scratch on him, but my father was badly burnt. And he was one of the first people who went to get a skin graft by this guy called McIndo. And it was called the Guinea Pig Club. So he was a founder member of the Guinea Pig Club because they'd never really done skin grafts. And so they were like treated like guinea pigs and, you know, like ears and things that were missing. And so he was traumatized, basically. So anyway, because I never saw him, but I always wanted to. I always felt I wanted to know him. And so it stayed with me. And then once I started doing my psychology course, I thought, well, I'll try and write to him because I knew that we were secrets. He married again. He didn't want us to, he didn't want his wife or their children to know that he remarried and had kids, 4 kids. So anyway, it was a very sort of weird relationship. I finally met him and he kind of was very inappropriate, kind of came on to me. And
very
so I thought, that's it. Yeah, it was really awful. And I thought, that's it. I'm not going to see him again. And then after a while, and he said he couldn't remember me as a child. He didn't have anything, you know, to show us. But then after a while, time went on and then he realized and said, now I had a dream about him. And I said, I want you, I don't know who you are. I want you to tell me who you are. Tell me about your accident. And I want you to write, because I always used to find writing easier than talking. Sure enough, took him many, many months, but he started writing. And I saw what he'd written, and it was good, and I started to know a bit about him. And then I thought, well, I guess that's the best I'm ever going to get, and gave copies to my siblings. And then after about a year or so, he started writing again, and he wanted to see me. By this time, he'd got a woman in his life, and he's kind of in his 80s at this time, 80s coming up to 90. And he wanted to see me, and that's when he gave me the logbook for when he had his accident, you know, all his bombing raids. He gave me the little scarf he'd wear, you know, when he was in his plane, the little guinea pig I got from him, you know, from the guinea pig club, all this stuff that had meaning that I never thought I was ever going to, not that I wanted it, but I wanted to have a connection. And I got it before he died. I really felt we connected.
So that that moment when he came on to you, which is like horrible.
Horrible.
You didn't hit him or...
No, because I didn't have the words. I didn't know. I'd never been in a situation like this before. It's like, finally, I've met my dad. And yes, I'd love to stay the night. Yes, lovely to hear from you, because his wife had kicked him out. So he kind of felt free. And then I saw we had to be sleeping in the same room, in single beds, like sort of that far apart. I mean, this old guy, I mean, I wouldn't have recognized him in the street. I just know that that was my dad. But it was horrible.
Awful, but it's nice that you were somehow able to get to something else at the end.
It was so meaningful to me. And when he then got together with this woman that he'd met years ago, because I think he was, you know, sort of seeing her while he was still seeing my mom in Africa, I told her what he was up to. And so she immediately put a stop to it and said he was doing all those things, not quite the same, but to her friends. So he was obviously getting away with it. And I think because he had been pretty damaged, you know, but my belief is by him starting to write, it was like suddenly he could remember things, and things were thawing inside him, all this stuff that he'd had locked in there for all those years. My feeling is that he it's like he thawed, he remembered, and then he had things he wanted to give me that were all part of his history.
Dr. Jenny Boyd, you've had such an extraordinary life, and I thank you so much for sharing it with us in your book, Jennifer Juniper, A Journey Beyond the Muse. It's a marvelous book. Congratulations. And I really thank you for hanging out with me today and spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Yeah. Thank you, Gary. It's really been fun and really good to talk to you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.